ideas and new technology are causing seismic shifts in the media industry. Where are we headed? What does it mean? Keep listening. Media strategist Gabriella Mirabelli talks with the brightest minds in entertainment and business. Meet the innovators, the risk takers, and the disruptors on the front lines of change from Hollywood, Wall Street, Silicon Valley, and beyond. The future is coming to a screen near you. Are you ready? This is the Up Next podcast with Gabriella Mirabelli.
Welcome to Up Next. I'm your host, Gabriella Mirabelli. My guest today is Chris Bailey, a productivity expert, coach, and author of hundreds of articles and two books on productivity. His first book, The Productivity Project, delves into the numerous lessons he learned and knowledge he acquired while on a one-year productivity pilgrimage. His latest book, Hyper Focus, released in August, helps people become more productive in a world of distraction. Hi, Chris. Thanks so much for joining us today. You certainly have an interesting background. You turned down a lucrative job to pursue this dream, to spend your year performing this experiment into the pursuit of productivity, which became your first book. Can you tell me a little bit about how you got started in this pursuit of productivity and how it led you to your most recent book, Hyperfocus?
Yeah, it's a long, weird, and winding journey, but it started way, way back in high school where I wanted to find the best ways to get like mid-90 grades, but while doing as little work as I possibly could and spending less. So I had more, because I'm ultimately a very lazy person.
My God, you must know my son. That's what he does.
So. Yeah. We just kind of like veg out. But that's why I'm so into productivity, because I don't think it's like a thing by which, a way through which we become more efficient. I think it's like a way that we can accomplish everything we have to do in a smaller amount of time. So we have more time for the things that are actually meaningful to us. And so we have more time to spend how we want. And so that obsession, it carried me through high school, university, where I still tried to, you know, get more done in a smaller amount of time. And then I received a few job offers after that point, because I'd worked at several corporations during university with the time that I'd created and freed up because I invested in productivity. But then I thought, okay, this is an idea that's been winding its way through my life. Why not take a stab at exploring this for a living? So I declined the jobs. I spent a year trying to become as productive as possible. I'm still trying to do that. And luckily, the work that I started after graduation, I didn't start with the following, but I gained one. And luckily, that allows me to write books and continue to nerd out about this stuff.
Awesome. One of the things that you've said is that your smartphone is chopping your life into tiny, meaningless pieces. And do you know what you're missing when you check your phone? And can you talk a little bit about that?
This is an idea that struck me when I was, this might sound a bit pretentious, but I was at an opera in Prague a couple of weeks ago with my fiance. And we were in the town square. And we were kind of on the balcony up top because we, you know, those were the cheaper seats. And we were looking down below. And probably around half of the people were alternating between soaking in the opera and like taking pictures of the opera to post on social media because, you know, they're humble bragging about being at an opera, much like I'm doing right now on the podcast. But they were alternating between soaking in the performance and looking at their phone. And in other words, they weren't becoming fully immersed in the experience. And I think, you know, this speaks to a lot of ideas that I wrote about in Hyperfocus, where, you know, when we're in front of a computer, for an example, we only focus on one thing for about 40 seconds before we switch to doing something else. And this is the state in which we live our lives so often. But our attention matters so much. You know, I think managing our attention these days, it matters more than just how we manage our time, because our attention is so limited, it's so constrained, but yet it contributes so much meaning to our lives. I have this theory that's, you know, it's informed by my meditation practice and a lot of the research that I've done, but that something like love, even love is like no different from just sharing quality attention with someone. You know, it's that presence of being with someone that makes our attention so powerful, but also can make us more productive. And so we never really experience one thing anymore. And because, you know, when we begin to experience something, we look at our phone every 40 seconds and we switch between things every 40 seconds. And it's, that there's so much meaning out there that we don't notice, I think.
Well, it's interesting because a lot of people feel that they're being productive by checking the phone, by being omni-available, that their busyness is their business.
Omni-available, I like that.
So why do you think, is it just the phone? What is it about our modern culture that makes it so difficult for people to be engaged over a sustained period of time? Is it the phone? What is it?
I think it's the fact that we get accustomed to such a high level of stimulation. And there are kind of three magnets that draw our attention in. And this is kind of an eye-opening piece of research that changed the way I thought about our attention, was that we're distracted a lot and we chop up our experiences quite often. But at the same time, it's not really our fault, because our attention gravitates naturally to anything that is three things: anything that's pleasurable, anything that we find threatening, and anything we find novel. There's even a novelty bias embedded within our mind's prefrontal cortex, where it releases dopamine for every new and novel thing we focus on. And so when we switch between things every 40 seconds, maybe we're in Excel, and then we switch to looking at our phone, then we switch back to Excel, then we check our email, and then we kind of fragment our attention in this way, there's so much dopamine coursing through our mind. And this compromises our productivity because we get accustomed to that level of stimulation. And when we have to suddenly lower our level of stimulation, like to dive into something, it proves very, very difficult because we get bored, we get anxious, we get restless. And so,
do we get depressed? I mean, isn't dopamine one of those things that has to do with depression? Is this?
Yeah. Like we kind of numb our minds into submission almost. And we're starting off on a bit of
a bit of a downer, right?
Yeah. People want to be happy, but it's like, how do you feel when you're using your phone? My fiance Arden, we were just hanging out the other day. She was on her phone in the living room and she looked really sad. And I asked her, what are you doing? And she's, I'm on Facebook. And it's like, okay, isn't the point of Facebook to connect with people and have these meaningful experiences and relationships? But how do you feel when you use social media versus when you're maybe on vacation and unwinding with a good book or with a good friend and really immersing yourself in an opera or any other experience? Like that's it's fascinating.
Right. It's almost you also say that laziness is a lost art.
Yeah.
And I love that because I'm inclined to laziness myself. So can you talk a little bit about the benefits of laziness? How does laziness benefit focus and productivity?
Yeah, I think it's one of the most underrated ingredients in becoming more productive. And like, I don't mean laziness in the sense of just kind of like vegging out and, using your phone and because you don't want to work. I mean proper idleness, where we let our mind wander a bit. We don't do that much in the moment. And the fascinating thing, there's this great quote what's his name? J.R.R. It's hard to say J.R.R. Tolkien. When I was recording my audiobook, the narrator, we had to like do three takes of his name. So easy to trip up on. But he has this great quote, not all those who wander are lost. And I think this is so true, not just with our lives, because this is where we find ideas, but with our attention. We rarely purposefully let our mind wander, but yet this is when our best ideas come to us. We're rarely focused when we're rarely coming up with these ideas when we're focused. It's like when we let our mind wander, when we're going for a walk through nature, when we're going for a run without our headphones, when we're taking a shower. The research shows that our mind wanders to think about the future 14 times as much at rest when compared to when we're focusing on something. We think about our goals 7 times as much when our attention is at rest. And so when our attention is at rest, so are we. We think about the future. We plan for the future. We connect the constellations of ideas that are swirling around in our mind while we also rest at the same time, because whenever we rest our attention, we rest ourselves. And so there are these fascinating benefits, but because we're switching between things so often, we rarely experience them.
Mm. So how do you, proper idleness, do you
proper
schedule
laziness.
Okay. So, proper laziness. Do you schedule it or do you work it into your day? Or is that meditation? Is meditation different from being idle? I mean, yeah, what?
I think the key is to find something that you genuinely enjoy doing that doesn't occupy your full attention. And so that might be something like, you know, investing time in a creative hobby. Like you like to paint, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Do you find that your mind kind of goes to fascinating places when you do?
I get into a sort of a creative pocket and I lose sense of time.
That's fascinating.
So it's really, I love it. And it definitely recharges me to do that. But I wouldn't say that that's idle. I mean, I guess it's just exercising a different, it's almost like part of my brain is I guess idling while another part is getting a workout.
I think that's the key. Like that when we're lazy, that we do something we do something that doesn't occupy our full attention. So that would occupy your full attention. But maybe something like photography is a great example, because we kind of wander around, we think about ideas, then we're focused on taking a picture, woodworking, you know, reading something that's fun that we can, you know, think about a little bit at the same time. Going on a nature walk. Nature is one of the most fascinating things for our creativity, especially. One study I encountered in writing the book, it found that we become about 50% better. That's 50, not 15, at creative problem-solving tasks. It lowers our levels of stress hormones in our body by around 16%, I think it is. It makes us calmer. It elevates our mood. You know, things like that. Going for a walk around the block at lunchtime. And I think a big part of it also is, you know, scheduling time for these things, but also minding the gaps day. I'm a big nerd about traffic flow. Traffic flows down the highway in addition to productivity. And if you look at the cars, what you'll notice is that what allows them to continue moving forward isn't how fast individual cars are moving, but rather it's how much space exists between the cars that allows traffic to continue moving forward. And I would argue, it's fascinating. Yeah. See, why wouldn't you be a nerd about something like that?
But it's really interesting. That's cool.
And I would argue that our work is the same way, where when we constantly switch from one thing to another, focus to focus, you know, and on, we never really let our attention rest. We never leave some space between things.
It's like a thought jam.
Yeah, exactly. We cause a mental traffic jam. And this leads us into spending our time on this mindless autopilot mode, because we don't think about our goals. We don't think about our future. We don't think about ideas. We don't approach our work from a more strategic direction, and we never rest. And so we have less energy to take on the more complex work. And so we actually gravitate to the things on our plate that are less complex than everything else. And so I think it's a combination of those two ideas, where we schedule these longer blocks of time. One of my favorite rituals is my daily constitutional, walking to and from a coffee shop. I choose one that's purposely far away from my house. I have a notepad. Parking at a spot way across the parking lot, and just letting your mind wander on the way, but also leaving gaps in your day so that things can move forward and you can think a little bit between things.
Right. I want to dive a little bit into, you had mentioned creativity, and there's a lot of different thought around creativity, sort of rules of thumb, what people think, and then what research shows. And a lot of people would argue that inspiration isn't something that can be forced or planned. But if you're working in a creative pursuit, there are deadlines and you have to come up with that idea. And so are there ways in which you can become actually more productive creatively? I mean, you mentioned nature and the creative benefit that being in nature is, but are there other things other than like going for a walk in the woods?
I think it depends what kind of creativity you need. And you know, I would classify that into two types of creativity. There's the logical creativity, where we need focused attention in order to do the work. So writing is a really good example of this. You know, you think about what you're doing, but it's in working through the things that you want to say logically, just putting pen to paper or hands to keyboard, that you can arrive at insights. And so there's that one that, you know, you kind of take small steps toward the creative solutions that you want and that you need to work. And then there's the more insight-based solutions that come to us that are these larger logical leaps in our thinking. And so I think it depends what kind of creativity that you need. And so sometimes it's only by letting our mind wander that we get the more insight solutions that come to us, these eureka insights where we suddenly, on a whim, connect a few constellations of dots that are swirling around in our mind. But if you're, say, a novelist, for example, maybe a few ideas will come to you that way. But working through projects more on a logical fashion, the reason that this mind wandering mode, I should preface this by saying I'm very much coming at the idea of creativity from an attentional standpoint, because that's kind of what I'm into now. But the fascinating thing about this mind-wandering mode is if you're looking for more of these insightful solutions, that letting your mind wander is a great way to arrive at them. And it's because of where our mind wanders to. It wanders to think about the future 48% of the time. It thinks about the present 28% of the time. And it thinks about the past less than we might think, only around 12% of the time. And so what it means when we let our mind wander is that we wander between these three mental destinations. So we remember an idea that we read about in a leadership book, for example, a few weeks ago in the past. Then we connect that to a problem that we're currently at an impasse with. And then we think to the future and we think, okay, well, this is how we can have a conversation later on in this week to deal with a difficult person that we're facing a situation with. So by connecting all three of these mental destinations, this is where we arrive at these insight problems. We notice cues in our environment. So I think this is another big part of creativity is the cues that we surround ourselves with. If you put people in a messy office versus in a clean office, people are more creative and come up with more ideas in a messy office because we encounter cues in that environment that lead us to creative insights.
So really?
Yes.
So the mess, that's really.
Yeah. Huh. So if you're having a brainstorming meeting, don't have it in some clean conference room that looks like an Apple commercial. Have it in like the messiest office that you can find. Go into nature. There's so many cues in nature and everybody will feel more recharged at the same time. And so one of the best cues are the information that we consume. And so we're constantly consuming information. You know, if you're listening to this podcast, you're processing information right now, and you're probably a person that surrounds themselves with a lot of these potential insight triggers. But you know, we see the world through the information that we've collected in the past. So looking at the ocean, for an example, you might think of the colors that you'd combine to create the place on the horizon where the ocean meets the sky. I might think of the words that I'd use to describe the ocean because I'm a writer. Somebody else, a photographer, might think about the aperture that they'd, or I don't even know anything mm-hmm. about it. I don't know why I keep... but it's we see the world through the information we've collected in the past, and we see our problems and our work through the information we've collected in the past. So, you know, I feel there's a lot of stuff crammed into there. But you know, if a problem requires insight, let your mind wander and expose yourself to new potential solution cues. But if you need to make small steps toward a solution, that's something that requires focus and that you have to work out.
Okay, well, sort of the reverse of this focus, procrastination. And you had an HBR article about procrastination and procrastination triggers and the ways to reduce those triggers. And I'd like to, can you talk a little bit about what triggers procrastination and then how you can work to reduce them?
Yeah, this is the fascinating thing about procrastination is like we think of, oh, I just don't want to do something. And so we put it off. But there are certain attributes that a task can have that make us more likely to put it off. You know, just as there are things that draw our attention in, there's things that repel our attention away from something. And make it.
Well, do they repel attention though? Because it seems like when you're procrastinating, you're actually curiously fixated on the thing you're not accomplishing.
Yeah, that's kind of curious. Yeah, you're totally right. I didn't really think about that. But they kind of repel us, not just they repel our behavior. But yeah, there's certain. I'll try to remember them here. But like, and the more of these triggers a task has, the more likely you are to put it off. And so those triggers are whether a task is boring, whether it's frustrating, whether it's difficult, whether it's ambiguous, so you're not sure how to do it, whether it's unstructured, so there's no clear path to do it, whether it's lacking in intrinsic rewards, and so the process of doing it isn't that rewarding, and whether it's lacking in meaning, and so you don't really care about doing it. Our taxes are a really good example of this. There's there's little meaning in giving money to the government a lot of the time. They're boring, they're frustrating, they're difficult. This is why the entire, I think it's $500 trillion tax prep industry exists in the United States, because it triggers essentially every single one of these things. But the idea, like an idea that kind of courses through all of the best productivity advice out there, I think, is this idea of deliberateness and intentionality. It is, I would argue, impossible to become more productive without becoming more intentional and more deliberate about what you work on in the first place and how you work on what you want to work on in the first place. And procrastination is a really, really good example of this. So when you notice that you're putting something off, oh, I don't want to do my taxes, I don't want to update my budget in Excel for my team, you can think, okay, what triggers is this setting off? It's boring, it's frustrating. So you can kind of make a game out of it in a way and reverse these triggers. So you know, doing your taxes, it's so boring. So I like to, what I do, I run a corporation. So that makes the whole process even worse. And
I was going to say, so much fun.
Jeez, I wish I just want to pay somebody to make the problem go away. But it turns out there's always work to do. No matter what your situation is, you're always on the hook for I'm getting angry just thinking about it. But this is what the patient is for.
Well, because then you're pulling together all the information that they're then dealing with. So you might as well do it anyway, right?
Every time I get a letter from the CRA, the Canada Revenue Agency, I always worry, this is it. This is going to be the time I get audited. And I'm the worst at keeping receipts. I'm the worst at all that stuff. And so, opening that letter even is, it's boring. It's frustrating. It's difficult. You don't know what's inside. But we can combat and kind of reverse these same triggers that lead us to put something off in the first place. So, we can make a game out of doing our taxes. This is what I do. I kind of bribe myself into doing my taxes. So for every 15 minutes I spend on them, I reward myself with $5 of just frivolous spending. I spend it usually on takeout food because food is my greatest weakness. I go to a nice cafe. I order a nice almond milk latte with extra espresso. I leave my phone at home, so there's no alternative things I can focus on. And so I essentially make it less boring, less frustrating. And you can kind of restructure, you can make a game out of it. Instead of doing your taxes for an entire afternoon, set a timer for half an hour. And in that half an hour, blow through as much as you possibly can. Find your mental resistance to working on something. This is something that I personally do for my meditation practice on the days when I'm really busy and I think I don't have time for meditation. I think, okay, do I feel like meditating for 45 minutes today? No, the thought of it puts me off. Okay, what about 30? Still 20? I could meditate for 20. So you kind of find that resistance level. And also doing a swap is another helpful way that's kind of related to that. So you think, okay, do I have time to meditate for 20 minutes today? No. But okay, do I have time to watch a 20-minute episode of Friends? Yeah, probably. Do I have time to go to Instagram for 20 minutes and check social media? Yeah, I do. And so it's okay, if I have time for that, I have time for meditation. It's really just that I don't have the attention for meditation.
Right. So you mentioned a term there, resistance level. And so you had said you should work within your resistance level. And by resistance level, you mean that your own personal limit? What does that mean? Can you give a little bit more around that?
Yeah. It's kind of how uncomfortable we feel about something. And so this is, it's totally subjective, but again, so is procrastination. So, we find the point at which we no longer feel resistance to doing something. And so, we can all do anything for basically a minute, right? So even if it's just, and this is a great way to kind of pull the the cord on the lawnmower and just get ourselves moving and get ourselves going. You know, if we're resisting cleaning our basement, you can kind of feel out that level of resistance. You know, you could clean your basement for 20 seconds. Okay, could you clean it for a minute? Yeah, probably. Could you clean it for five? Yeah, sure. I don't want to spend 10 minutes, but I could spend five. And the thing about this resistance is purely psychological because of something that sets off these triggers of procrastination. But once we get started on doing something, this resistance is almost always stacked at the beginning of us doing something. So if we clean our basement for a minute, we could go on for hours, but it takes us sometimes hours to build up to the minute. And so it's a great way to get started. And it's a little mind hack to get started right away.
Right. Well, that's really interesting. It is because it's almost like that initial inertia to get you into the thing. You've mentioned several times during our conversation, caffeine and coffee. So I'm a big fan, and I'm interested in what your thoughts are on coffee during the workday and if it's an asset or a crutch.
What is your caffeinated beverage of choice?
Well,
do you have many?
I have, it depends on the season, but if it's sort of cold, then I like a soy latte with cinnamon in before the soy, please.
If it's
hot, I like an iced soy latte or almond latte. My local place, I don't have almond milk, so I have to go for the soy, but my preference is to have almond milk. So when you mentioned that, I was like, oh man, after my own heart.
Are you into the whole pumpkin spice scene or no?
Oh God, no, that's sort of horrible, isn't it? I mean, unless you like it, but.
Well, if you're into that kind of thing.
No, I just, you know, I feel like I'm drinking potpourri if I have that.
I always like when the first day it comes out, I get one and then I regret it for about 364 days until.
Well, do you know that scene in Big where he eats accidentally the caviar eggs and he tries to spit them out because it just is horrible on his tongue? That's how I feel about pumpkin spice latte.
That's how repelled you are by it.
Yes, I am not a fan. I can totally do without it.
Oh, that's hilarious. I remember the first time eating caviar, like Googling how to eat caviar as you were eating it. Like I've never felt like it's so hard to look cool eating, like doing that. I have like these random thoughts when I go on walks in the morning, and I had one today and I was like making a
but you didn't answer. Is caffeine an asset or a crutch?
Yeah, it's very
before
good.
We move
it's
on. Good.
It boosts our mental and our physical performance in almost every single measure. It bolsters our attention. It increases our vigilance. It allows us to stick with one thing for longer, but it narrows our focus. And so like maybe I could have used some this morning getting off on these tangents, but that's the fascinating thing is it makes us less creative, but it makes us more focused because it makes our attention more inhibited. It's when our attention is less inhibited that we're the most creative, and when it's the most inhibited that we're the most focused and the most productive. We invariably crash after we consume a cup of coffee, right? Like, you know, after we start to metabolize the caffeine out of our system. And so because of that crash, I'm a big advocate for consuming caffeine strategically and deliberately, like much of the rest of the productivity advice that's worth following, instead of habitually. And so when we actually benefit from the energy boost that caffeine gives us. And so before doing an interview such as this one, before having an important conversation with our boss, before hunkering down to write a novel or create something that's valuable and makes an impact. These are activities that actually benefit from the energy boost that caffeine gives us. But the fascinating thing is it depends on whether you're an introvert or an extrovert. Because if you're an introvert and say you're going to give an important talk, if you're an introvert, caffeine stimulates you, but so does the talk. The talk stimulates you more by default. And so it may over stimulate you
and cause your performance.
Cause your performance to suffer. Whereas if you're an ambivert like I am, or an extrovert, then you'll benefit. Your performance will benefit from the extra stimulation that caffeine.
What's
and the situation
an ambivert?
Is. Ambivert is kind of somewhere in between. So we like to categorize people, I'm an introvert or I'm an extrovert, but it's a spectrum. It's not like there's two buckets. And so an ambivert is somebody who they need to recharge when being around people, but they also kind of fall somewhere in between.
I think I'm that. I'm that in the middle then. Yeah. Can you give me the list of things that it's hard to look cool while doing?
Well, the first one on the list is one I've already mentioned, and it's Googling how to eat caviar while eating caviar, because I remembered that memory. But there are three other things on the list. So it's a very incomplete list. The other things on the list are swatting a bee. Another thing that's hard to look cool doing is eating a banana. It's very hard to look cool doing that. And the third
I would say
is,
impossible.
Like you want to cut it with a knife and fork. I don't like. And the third is using the word vacay, like vacation. It's hard to.
Nobody says that.
I've heard two people say this in real life, like
in speech, like really.
In a non-ironic way. I kid you not. And I'm very shy. I'm very introverted. And so I don't spend time.
But you found you just had to slap them, right? Sorry.
I slapped them inside my mind.
Okay. Not being an extroverted and your violent tendencies. You had mentioned some very particular statistics about where your mind goes for future, present, and past. How do they determine that? Are you conducting studies? Are you reading academic papers? Where is the data that underpins all of your work? Where does that come from?
It comes from a lot of academic research. And this is hard to measure because this is done through experience sampling. So, they ask somebody in a situation, like it's usually to stare at some crosshairs on a screen. So something that is so boring that it lets people's mind wander. And then periodically they throw a pop-up on the window and they say, okay, what are you thinking about? What's on your mind? Are you focused on the crosshairs, first of all? And if the answer is yes, then they're what's called perceptually coupled to the stimuli. And if the answer is no, then they ask, what were you thinking about? And so like a lot of it comes from the research. And what I would say is that the exact numbers don't matter much because different studies will say different things. But the key, I think, is to realize that within our mind is this what's called a prospective bias. And so we have a bias toward looking at the future and to a large extent the present over reliving the past. And so we think our mind wanders to the past quite a bit, but it's just often that we remember those mind-wandering episodes because they're often more vivid. Now, boredom, it leads our mind to wander, but not in a way that we find pleasant. No, nobody enjoys boredom, but it's kind of this feeling that we experience as we have to suddenly adjust downward into a lower level of stimulation. Once we get accustomed to that lower level of stimulation, we're fine. We can, we no longer feel anxious and restless about the present moment. But while we adjust downward into it, we do feel that anxiety that manifests itself in our mind. And so, maybe boredom isn't worth experiencing, but definitely letting our mind wander while we do something habitual. Talking about creativity, revisiting that idea, we have been shown to come up with a greater number of creative insights when we do something habitual, like taking a shower, like swimming laps, like just sipping our morning coffee or latte with a notepad and nothing else in our environment. Habitual tasks lead us to more creative insights while making what we're doing fun. It makes mind wandering fun while letting us rest, while actually anchoring our attention, because we're going to continue letting our mind wander for the duration of the cup of coffee or the laps or swimming or the shower we're taking. So it's fascinating. This and this is something I didn't expect to find looking at the research on our attention. I thought, okay, it's all about focus. Like, how do we focus in a world of distraction? And that's what's on the cover of the book. But there's this other side of focus, which is unfocusing, that nobody really talks about, nobody really thinks about, but it's the most creative way that we can use our mind. And when we couple that creativity with the focused productivity, where we get to accomplish more, then that's really where we become our best selves.
Right. That's really interesting. How you also have some thoughts around using the, when you're tired, leveraging that.
Yeah. So when we're tired, here's the fascinating thing. Our mind's prefrontal cortex, which is the logical center of our brain, is the least inhibited when we're tired. And so this usually happens the first thing in the morning. So scans have shown that that our minds are least inhibited. And so this is when our best ideas come to us, because we don't really hold anything back. It's kind of like having a glass of wine while letting your mind wander. You know, alcohol works for much the same reason. it makes our mind less inhibited, which allows us to come up with more free-form thoughts. The fascinating thing about alcohol, though, and where it's really, it has a lot of downfalls as it relates to focus. But so it makes us more creative in this way. But at the same time, we become less aware of where our mind is wandering to in the first place. And so,
so we don't get to remember or take advantage of where it's wandered?
Exactly. So it's wandering to fascinating ideas, but we don't notice that it's wandering because we might as well be
loaded
because we're smashed. So this is why we don't remember as much when, well, there's a few reasons, but because we don't check up on what's in our attention. We don't practice what's called meta-awareness. So just noticing where our attention is at. And so, yeah, it's harder to focus, you know, because our mind is so much less inhibited. But we can actually take advantage of the periods of time in which we have less energy, because when we have the least amount of energy, this is when we're the most creative. And so if you're doing creative work, it's so fun talking about creativity. If you're doing creative work, make sure you do that work maybe before a cup of coffee, which zeroes your attention in on something. Maybe if it's at night, have a glass of wine as you paint, for example. Not too much, because you don't want to be that uninhibited. But and so, like, take advantage of when you're tired, because that's when your best ideas will often strike you.
That's really interesting. I paint and I will have a glass of wine at night, and that is absolutely true. How interesting.
Do you notice that you're happier with your paintings and that they're more creative when you have
it? Well, I just, the whole thing, it just usually clicks in a lot better for me then. So
very
interesting. We have actually also, I mean, talking about, you know, being hyper-focused on what's going on, we've actually run through all of our time together.
Oh, we have,
and
yeah.
It feels like it went through in a snap.
Yeah, it really.
So before we leave our conversation, how can people find out more about you and find out more about your book, Hyper-Focus?
Yeah, thanks for having me. The book is called Hyperfocus, How to Be More Productive in a World of Distraction. And it's available wherever books are sold. If you like the sound of my voice, there's an audio book. And if you don't like the sound of my voice, there's a physical book and an ebook. And my site is called alifeofproductivity.com. And yeah, I'm always uncomfortable promoting stuff, but this is one of the ideas that I've had and projects that I've done that I'm so excited to get out into the world. And I can't wait to hear what other people think about it too.
Well, fantastic. Thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you.
We've reached the end of another episode of Up Next, and I'd like to close by thanking a few important people who helped bring the program to life. First, my friend, Rob Naughton, the amazing voice artist who recorded our open. And of course, thanks to my production team over at Microfame Media. And a big thank you to our guest, Chris Bailey. And of course, most importantly, all of you, the members of our amazing audience. Thank you. I'll be talking to you again next week, right here on Up Next.